Get Lit.
Welcome back to Get Lit, the literary podcast where we discuss famous works of literature and the authors who wrote them. I'm your host, Steph Spars, joined here by my co-host,
John Stricker.
And it is Earth Day, everybody. It is Earth Day when we are recording this episode. So maybe you will hear this a year from now on Earth Day, or, you know, just 2 days after the fact. I think every day should really be Earth Day. But regardless, I am very, very excited to be doing a biography of John Muir today in celebration of this magnificent holiday.
Stephanie, I think there's a really cool overlap between the celebration of literature and the celebration of Earth Day, because they're both things that I think unite us as a species, a shared love for trying to better understand the human condition, which is inextricably linked to the environment that we're a part of, which is our Earth. So I think that there's a really strong connection between Earth Day and a celebration and investigation of literature. So I'm really excited that we have this kind of coincidence that we're recording the podcast today.
Excellent. I think that is a beautiful way of looking at that reflection, and one that I have taken a little time. Folks, if you haven't necessarily checked out our social media on Instagram or Facebook, I put some of our favorite literary Earth-related quotes from authors, some who we've done, some who we haven't, that you might enjoy. So if you didn't get a chance to see those and are looking for a short Earth Day meditation, maybe take a second to go look at that. And maybe, John, that illustrates your connective idea between celebrating Earth Day and celebrating literature. And I think those do both. Of course, I put a Kurt Vonnegut quote on there for you. And then there's, of course, Mary Oliver, along with many other wonderful writers. I figured that was a good reflection of all of us.
It's well curated, Stephanie. It was a joy to read.
Thank you. Well, before we kind of dive into this week's episode, John, we have had kind of an interesting last couple of weeks. We hope you enjoyed the eclipse. And then we did a live show. So there's been all kinds of fun things that have happened in between now and the last time we had a normal recording session. So can you update us? What's the literary news of the landscape that we need to understand?
It has been a while since there was a news article, and in recognition of the environment and Earth Day, I'll maybe talk about a mental environment that is common among poets and artists in general, and it is an article that came out in The Collector, and it's titled, "What is the Myth of the Struggling Artist in Literature?"
Interesting.
So, right? Because I think it is something that we kind of identify with, that, you know, to make art, you have to suffer and be impoverished and strive in some type of visceral way. And this kind of explores where that trope, where that kind of mode of thinking came from. And so the article is honestly really beautiful. It makes great use of pictures of famous authors or paintings that are close to the literary movements of the time that it's profiling. And it starts off actually in the middle, I think, of this mythology in the Beat Generation. So
okay,
there's pictures.
That makes sense.
Right? Of like Jack Kerouac. It quotes from Allen Ginsberg's Howl. I think the famous line that we're all maybe at least tangentially familiar with is, "The best minds of my generation destroyed by madness, starving, hysterical, naked." And I think that is a good parallel to the idea of the struggling artist, in that it shows some type of suffering or mental, emotional turmoil. So I think that that was a cool kind of connection to the Beat Poets. It moves on to George Orwell, and he kind of lampoons the idea of the struggling artist.
Of course he does.
And his quote struck me. It goes, "Life on £2 ceases to be a heroic gesture and becomes a dingy habit."
Nice.
I like that. It's not noble. It doesn't make poverty and suffering noble, which I think people sometimes feel compelled to do. So that's taking a step back from the beat poets to George Orwell. And then even further, it goes back to what they considered a seminal figure in this idea of mythologizing the striving and struggling artist. And it was someone who I wasn't very familiar with, but it's Knut Hamsun. He wrote Hunger in 1890 and okay. ended up winning the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1920.
Wow.
But he kind of was the archetype that Orwell was lampooning.
All right.
And his protagonist in this book kind of purposefully uses starvation to alter their consciousness at one point. So he has this line from his poem, "My head became light and floaty," and he uses the sensation specifically to write. So that seems, again, like mythologizing this state of being and trying to romanticize it. It moves on to the French Revolution, which is where at least this article contends that this trope came from. And they specifically point to the fact that for maybe one of the first times, poets, writers, and creators kind of lost what they call aristocratic patronage and forfeited a stable income in order to practice their craft. So you go back further maybe than the French Revolution and you see a system of patronage where even like Shakespeare was staked by the crown, right, to complete some of his work. Mm-hmm. But here, after overthrowing the aristocracy, that source of income is no longer available to poets and writers. And last but not least, it gets in a quote by Charles Baudelaire, who I think we all know is the moodiest of the moody poets. and I just have to read this. Quote, "Poets cannot hope to fit in, either in a democratic or an aristocratic society, in a republic or a constitutional monarchy. Illustrious unfortunates, born to suffer the harsh apprenticeship of genius here below, amidst the crowd of unfortunate, mediocre souls."
All right. Good for you, then.
So he needed a hug really bad, but I think he probably did a lot to perpetuate the myth of the struggling artist so that the people who came after him were really interested in kind of mirroring this romantic behavior. And I guess I never really, before this article, questioned the idea of the struggling artist. It was just kind of taken for granted that that was what an artist had to do, at least maybe in my mind. And just to shed some light on the fact that it might be a more recent development than I thought, kind of puts it in a new perspective and makes me wonder about maybe the economics, honestly, of literature and whether or not it's possible to make art while one's comfortable. So I think I have more wrestling to do with this idea, and this article, I think, came at a good time for me to continue to explore these themes. So again, it's called "What is the Myth of the Struggling Artist in Literature?" And you can find it at The Collector.
Very interesting. It's always, I think, kind of cool to go back and explore the history of something. And I love an author who can sort of take and trace an idea throughout the course of time. We've had a couple investigations of the Oxford English Dictionary with students this past week, actually, because of that, which is fun. But of course, interesting to examine this myth and where we get that idea of the artist. And I think in profiling so many different authors on GitLit, I don't know that we can fill that pattern. We've had some really brilliant and incredible writers who have definitely come from places of poverty. And we've had some really incredible authors that have come from spaces of extreme wealth. And then people in between who've lost or gained their fortunes. So regardless, I think kind of an interesting idea to, I guess, glamorize. You know, I think there's a lot of glamour in that concept, especially in other forms of media, in portraying what these tortured, starving artists have done and created. You know, how many movies have we seen about that? But very interesting examination. Thank you so much for bringing that to us.
Of course. I think the Orwell quote is what's going to stick with me most about it being dingy. So
great. Just don't think about its creator too much or the speaker too much.
Yeah, exactly.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for bringing that to our attention, John. I think an excellent perspective to share, as always. We'll go ahead right now and turn to John Muir, who I know you know some about, John. And it feels like he fits right in kind of with the Earth Day theme. Again, it's always exciting to do an author that we sort of topically connect to something that's going on in the world around us. And so for one of the people who I think is so tied up in kind of Earth-oriented lore, I suppose, John Muir seemed like a natural fit to do this week. So it was lucky that we got to record on Earth Day, and hopefully we all kind of continue to celebrate it here on after.
Definitely. And who knows, Earth Day might not have existed in this country without him. So I think he's right to be profiled today.
Excellent. Well, then let's head across the ocean. We're actually not starting in the States, and learn a little bit more about John Muir. John Muir was born April 21st, 1838, which is both quite a long time ago and just one day ago for us here in 2024. And this, of course, makes him a Taurus. And according to famousbirthdays.com, he is the eighth most popular Taurus named John. Hmm. Some other famous John Tauruses include John Cena, noted actor and wrestler.
Actor can be loose, I think.
Well, someone has done work in Hollywood and some of us haven't. So I'm going to say that if there's going to be one of us calling it out, it maybe shouldn't be us.
Okay, very good.
And another Taurus John is John Oliver.
Oh, cool.
Yes. And then he is the fourth most popular person with the last name Muir. The first, of course, being David Muir, who is a news anchor and journalist. Everyone's favorite.
I think for me, John Muir definitely tops this list.
That's fair. He's also the third most popular Taurus scientist. I feel like that, again, is a very unique category, yeah, especially here on Get Lit. Other famous Taurus scientists include Robert J. Oppenheimer, of the movie fame. Apparently, he also invented the atom bomb.
Allegedly.
And allegedly, like the presidents, and also Howard Carter, noted famous archaeologist.
Oh, cool. I think he discovered Tutankhamun's tomb.
That sounds about right. We'll go with that one. He's also the number one most popular person born in 1838 and conservationist. Mm. So he did get two first place tops, which I thought was very interesting.
Good. Gold medal for John.
So a little bit about his parents. His father was Daniel Muir, who was a very harsh disciplinarian, a member of the Calvinist faith tradition, yikes, which puts you in a very specific category of religious upbringing. And his mother's name was Anne Gilroy. They have eight children. John falls sort of right in the middle. But they have Margaret, Sarah, John, David, Daniel, Anne, and Mary, who are twins, and Joanna.
That's a lot of kids and very traditional names. It sounds like they were really ready for this experience of naming their children.
Yeah, I mean, I think they just went through the Bible and they just picked the first five they saw and just rolled with those.
Like so many have done before and since.
Yeah. So I mentioned we're across the ocean for this, and that is true because John Muir actually grows up in the small coastal town of Dunbar, Scotland. He's raised in a four-story stone house and didn't spend much time there. He actually spent most of his time running around outside, which makes sense, I think, for his future. He spends time play fighting with his siblings. They would reenact romantic battles from Wars of Scottish Independence, as you do as a young person. He would go and hunt for bird's nests with his friends. They would kind of do their own mini science experiment, which I thought was kind of interesting, in which they would have a competition between them to compare notes about who knew where the most bird's nests were located. This feels kind of distinctly like something you might do.
I think so. Like, it's almost like a hide and seek with the birds, and like you get to show off that you found a lot of them. Maybe an early Where's Waldo?
Except it's just nests. Yeah. Just bird nests. He has a lot of early memories of taking walks with his grandfather from the age of 3 years and on, and really enjoyed exploring the coastline and the countryside. So again, it makes a lot of sense that he would become interested in natural history. He was also quite inspired by Scottish naturalist Alexander Wilson. So he's also pulling influences from some of the literature that he's exposed to around this time.
It's cool that even at an early age, he's synthesizing like larger movements like naturalism with his experiences in the wild.
Yes. This is, again, something that he will kind of become known for as an adult and spend a lot of his time doing. Unfortunately, though, his father believed that anything that sort of distracted one from studying the Bible was frivolous and should be punished. But John did not agree with this. So they spent a lot of time at odds with one another. John would get lashings quite a bit from his father for not being willing to read the Bible as regularly as he maybe should have or his father wanted him to.
I don't understand that because a Calvinist believes in predetermination. So it doesn't matter how well you study the Bible because you're already saved.
Right. But you could do better on Earth. So John attends local schools growing up. But when he was 11 in 1849, the family actually moves to the United States. He is able to keep his accent for the rest of his life, which is very exciting. Cool. So shout out to his parents for waiting. And they settle, takes them about 6 weeks to travel from Scotland to the United States, and then another 4 days to navigate from the East Coast through the Great Lakes to Wisconsin. So I don't know that we can technically count him as a Midwestern author. I think we should claim him anyway, even though he's literally very distinctly associated with the West, then Scotland, and then maybe Portage, Wisconsin. But let's claim it.
It is the first place he landed in the U.S. for a long period of time, so.
Yeah, see? Since then, it has been designated a National Historical Landmark, which is also exciting. And this is Fountain Lake Farm, so that area you could go to if you were a Muir fan today. His father decided that the Church of Scotland was too lenient, of course. So that's actually another influence on it. They leave to join a congregation called the Campbellite Restoration Movement, specifically the Disciples of Christ. So John is given the task to read the Bible every day. And within the year, he's able to recite all of the New Testament and most of the Old Testament by heart and sore flesh.
Wait.
Quote, end quote.
What's the last part?
By heart and sore flesh.
Oh.
So it seems like it took him a while to get there, and physically that was displeasing to his father. So
I don't like that, but I guess he finished the task.
Right. So he grows up and he actually remains very spiritual, but not necessarily in the Orthodox tradition, which again, I think we kind of get for a lot of our authors is that they find a lot of spiritual fulfillment and investigation in other things that aren't necessarily connected to something distinctly religious. And I think we'll see pretty quickly that for John, a lot of that also is tied directly to nature. He reflects on this and says, quote, "I never tried to abandon creeds or code of civilization. They went away of their own accord, without leaving any consciousness of loss," end quote.
For all of the mistreatment that he suffered, the fact that he was able to maybe let go of these systems without any type of ill will, it sounds, seems to be quite a feat. And maybe that was made possible by his intense connection with nature, but at the same time, I think it takes a strong person to move past that mistreatment and characterize it as being let go of so softly as he just did.
Yes, he will refer to a creator-like figure in later writings as, quote, purely a manufactured article as any puppet of a halfpenny feeder, end quote. So there might have been a little bit of bite in there, but regardless, he seemed to be at peace with it. So
sure, but I wonder if that bite didn't come from his desire for people to appreciate the actual mechanics of nature rather than ascribing it all to some all-knowing being. Like, by doing that, you lose an aspect of some of the beauty. I think it would be interesting to see that quote in more context.
Yes. Well, this hopefully will be the launch of an investigation of John Muir. So please let us know if you come across anything particularly interesting. At age 22, he enrolls at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He pays for it himself. As you can guess, his father wasn't particularly supportive of this. And he takes his first botany lesson there, specifically under a massive black locust tree next to North Hall. Another student, this is sort of a story about his time there, plucks a flower from the tree and uses it to explain how the grand locust is a member of the pea family related to the straggling pea plant. And 50 years later, John describes this particular day in his autobiography as, quote, "This fine lesson charmed me and sent me flying into the woods and meadows in wild enthusiasm," end quote.
I think that's the power of observation and of science, natural science specifically, in that there's such a joy in understanding how things are interconnected. And it seems on the face of it almost absurd to say that a wandering pea plant and a giant locust might be related in some way, and for it to make sense and to believe it because of the evidence that's been shown to you. I can imagine that that would be so powerful.
Yes, especially if it, again, illuminates a connection to something that you feel deeply connected to, but maybe don't understand, right? Like, although John spent a lot of his childhood running around, it's another thing to understand something from an alternate perspective, in this case, this sort of scientific perspective. So I think it's really exciting that he got to have that. So Muir becomes lifelong friends with his chemistry professor, whose name was Ezra Carr, and his wife, Jeannie, and they would inspire his lifelong interest in chemistry and the sciences. So again, kind of finding ways to connect and expand and explore what he was interested in. And he attends classes for about 2 years, but is never listed as anything but a first-year student due to his unusual selection of courses. His class records just say, quote, "irregular gent," end quote. And unsurprisingly, he would never graduate.
I feel like in a different world, Stephanie, that would be you taking strange Victorian love poetry and adjacent classes as long as they would let you.
I genuinely cannot think of anything that I would adore more,
right,
than being like allowed to run around in nature and take interesting classes at a college. I think that's my ideal form. That's my self-actualization. That's my fullest actualized self.
Yeah, well, you have your retirement plan all set up for you.
Excellent. When is that? Oh, wait, 55 years. I'm a public high school teacher. Okay. In 1864, he leaves Wisconsin to follow his brother Daniel to southern Ontario. Daniel had been there for about a year, and he was seeking to avoid the draft.
I was just about to say, this seems suspicious.
Yep. And that's why. And so then John Muir will spend the spring, summer, and fall exploring the woods and swamps. He collects plants around Lake Huron's Bay until he runs out of money. And then he joins his brother again, and they start to work at the William Trout and Charles J. Sawmill and a rake factory. Everyone's favorite business.
I never knew he worked for a rake factory.
Fun fact.
Yeah. What a strange job. Okay.
Somebody's got to do it.
Yeah, I guess they do.
So they will actually wind up living with the Trout family in Trout Hollow on Big Head River. And they would still run around the landscape during their free time. He would spend this time, as he described it, quote, botanizing, which is just collecting and cataloging plants. And he'll stay there, arguably, debatably, until Trout Hollow burns down in February of 1866.
Yikes.
And then he needs a change of plan.
I mean, some of these names seem right out of like a Frog and Toad novel.
Which also might be another version of self-actualization for me personally. So John returns to the United States, but this time he goes to Indianapolis. Shout out Kurt Vonnegut. Mm-hmm. And guess where he works this time?
A brewery.
No, it's a wagon wheel factory.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So he's very good at this. He's very good at making wagon wheels.
That's amazing. It sounds like it'd be difficult.
John, could you outline the skills needed to be successful at wagon wheel factory making?
Yeah, well, you need to be able to carve wood and assemble the wheel. And I'm sure there's an element of sanding involved, and jointery, and carpentry, and maybe some fastening experience. Am I on track, Stephanie?
You know, I wouldn't be the one to ask. I've never worked in a wheel factory, but that sounds fine. So he gets promoted very quickly to be the supervisor. He makes about $25 a week, which is about $491.09 in today's money, which would have been a lot of money back then. So he's doing very well. But then unfortunately, in early March of 1867, he's working at the factory when a tool that he was using slips and cuts the cornea of his right eye, which sounds horrifying and awful.
Yes.
But his left eye, out of sympathy for the right eye, also fails. Oh, so he's confined to a dark room for 6 weeks in order to regain his sight. He's not sure if at that point he will be blind forever, but fortunately he is able to regain it. And he saw the world in a very new light, I guess, both literally and metaphorically. And he reflects on this and says, quote, "This affliction has driven me to the sweet fields. God has to nearly kill us sometimes to teach us lessons," end quote. So there's still a little bit of faith-based investigation there. But I just, again, can't necessarily imagine being in the dark for 6 weeks in order to hopefully potentially regain your eyesight.
Yeah, that'd be a harrowing time.
Yeah. So this also kind of launches him into this new purpose. He's decided that some of his dreams include exploration and study of plants. And he does this on a much grander scale beyond just frolicking about after work. So in September of 1867, John embarks on a 1,000-mile walk from Kentucky to Florida.
As one does. To celebrate their newfound sight after going blind working in a wagon wheel factory. These are the quintessential American steps.
Right, literally. He recounts his experience in his book. So if you want to know how this went, you can read A 1,000-Mile Walk to the Gulf. That's the title of the book.
Listen, you are not going to be tricked by an unambiguous title.
No, he wants to be clear. He has no specific route to get there. He decides instead he needs to go by, quote, "the wildest, leafiest, and least trodden way I could find," end quote. So he is definitely after that, like, road less traveled by approach, but not the sarcastic way.
Right.
And he arrives in Cedar Key, Florida, and begins working for Richard Hodgson's sawmill. So he's back in the sawmill. After that experience, I don't know how willing I would be to work in a mill. I don't know.
But I don't know how many other options you have.
That's fair, but working doesn't totally seem to be his MO all of the time anyway.
Yeah.
If he's walking 1,000 miles, it doesn't really seem like that's what it's about.
I mean, can you imagine explaining a gap on your resume? It's like, oh, I was just off walking 1,000 miles between Kentucky and Florida. Are you ready to hire me, person?
Well, it worked for him. So he must have had a good interview. It was probably the Scottish accent. Unfortunately, 3 days into the job, he catches malaria and almost dies. And he spends 3 months in the Hodgson's home in an unreliably delirious state before he's able to move around the house and look outside.
Oh my gosh.
He, again, a couple different brushes with various forms of death.
Yeah, I think it's someone is trying to tell him not to work in a factory.
Right. And it might be God. Anyway. So in early January of 1868, he climbs up to the roof of the Hodgson home to watch the sunset, which sounds very lovely and romantic. And from there, he's able to see a ship in the harbor called the Island Bell. And he learns that it was going to set sail for Cuba. And so naturally, he needed to get on that boat immediately. So he does. And then the boat winds up in Havana. And so he spends a lot of his days studying shells and flowers and visiting the city's botanical gardens.
It sounds wonderful.
I know. Like I said, it doesn't really feel like work is the priority. I'm just saying. After he spends a little bit of time in Cuba, he winds up back in New York City again and then books a passage to California. California is a new state. The United States government is exploring it still and making these investigations. So it seems like this is a good place for him to go. And he serves as a guide and artist for the United States Coast and Geodetic Survey on the survey of the 39th parallel across the Great Basin of Nevada and Utah. So that really seems like an applicable use of his skills in a quote-unquote jobs-like setting.
I'm sure he was laser-focused only at his task at hand and not at botanizing.
Right. Yeah, he was busy. He then winds up going up to San Francisco. He actually literally hates it. It's way too busy. It's too industrial. It's too much of a city. So he asks this person that he encounters where he should go next. And somebody suggests Yosemite. So he leaves again and heads to Yosemite.
Which is just a place.
Right.
Right? It's just a random valley. Like, it's not an anything.
So immediately, once he gets there, he does walk, by the way. Once he gets there, he writes that, quote, he was overwhelmed by the landscape, scrambling down steep cliff faces to get a closer look at the waterfalls, whooping and howling at the vistas, jumping tirelessly from flower to flower. End quote. We all kind of know, I think, hindsight 2020 thing, that John Muir is deeply associated with the national parks. I think very specifically Yosemite, but this will sort of be the love of his life for the rest of his life.
And the quote that you've just given with that almost childlike excitement and enthusiasm, I think is a quintessential characteristic that at least I associate with John Muir, like just an unfiltered love and excitement of nature.
Absolutely. And it is sort of fun to see him, I think, in that whimsical capacity too. I think a lot of these quotes are I think a lot of us maybe picture sort of like an old white guy with a beard for John Muir, and it's sort of fun to see this like whimsical version of him. He returns to California for a time, but will go back to Yosemite to work as a shepherd for a season when you had shepherds out there. He would climb a lot of mountains, including Cathedral Peak and Mount Dana. He hikes an old trail down to Bloody Canyon and Mono Lake. And this will also then lead him to build a small cabin along Yosemite Creek. It was designed so that a section of the creek would actually flow through the corner of a room. Oh. So he could always enjoy the sound of running water, which is so poetic. It makes me want to like dig up a corner and put a fountain in my house just so I can hear it. And he lived there for about 2 years. And while he's there, he'll write this period into his book called The First Summer in the Sierra in 1911. So this feels like, I guess, like Henry David Thoreau. If Henry David Thoreau, like, actually did what he wrote about.
Right. If he didn't have his mom do his laundry on the weekends, then this is what it would be like.
In 1876, John is 38 years old, and the American Association for the Advancement of Science publishes one of his papers on his investigation of Yosemite plant life. He reads a lot of Ralph Waldo Emerson, speaking of the Transcendentalists, and his essays, who writes a lot about the kind of life that John is living, right? This is, I think, at this point in the Transcendental movement, kind of the ideal, right? You go live amongst nature, you find ways to appreciate it. It means more in terms of connecting your body and your spirit to something higher. It's very lofty and idealistic, I think, in that way. And so it would make sense that he would connect to Ralph Waldo Emerson's essays. And he would often travel alone to the backcountry of Yosemite, carrying, quote, only a tin cup, a handful of tea, a loaf of bread, and a copy of Emerson, end quote.
I mean, transcendentalist, he might associate himself as, but there's a slight bent of romanticism there too.
Right. I think there is a nice Venn diagram there between those things, honestly.
Right.
Especially because that does not sound like the ideal way to travel.
No.
As someone who really enjoys nature and really likes to be outside and enjoys camping, et cetera, et cetera. That's a little much for me. I don't know that I could do that.
A little more prep, a little bit more tools and preparedness, I think I would want going off into the wilderness, yeah. But still also bringing Emerson. Like, I don't blame him.
Yeah. Like, yes, and.
Yes,
and. We'll do all of these things and bring a tent. Okay. So the years pass and he becomes something of a fixture in the valley. He's respected by newcomers and frequenters. He's kind of got this like hermit vibe going on, this sort of like recluse, but like in a good way. He's known for his natural history knowledge, his skills as a guide. And to top all of this, this is, I think, again, makes him a very interesting author to profile, is that he's a very good storyteller. Artists, scientists, celebrities would make a point of meeting him. They'd sit with him by a campfire. He'd be in his overcoat reading Emerson under the stars. Again, this sort of very romantic or poetical experience in nature. And lots of people joined him on these. One of those celebrities actually is Ralph Waldo Emerson, which I thought was very, very cool.
That's really cool. I'm sure that Muir fanboyed really hard over the fact that his favorite author made the trek out to see him.
I mean, he could fangirl. That's fine.
Yeah, he can fangirl.
Let him fangirl. So Emerson arrives in Yosemite during a tour of the Western United States, and they spend a day together. And it's after this day that Emerson actually offers him a teaching position at Harvard. So he's very impressed with him. But John will decline ultimately, writing, quote, I never for a moment thought of giving up God's big show for mere profship, end quote.
I mean, he understood what was important to him, and I give him a lot of credit for that.
Yes. One thing that was not important to him was being married. And again, this is somewhat controversial at the time, of course. Like, expectations are that you would do so. He is really unattached to the things around him. Again, mostly unemployed with very few prospects at a career. So again, he sort of achieves this mythic or legendary status just being who he is. But it's not like this is a comfortable living that he's making a great deal of money on, or he's seeing, you know, a critical success about, which again, very interesting. He experiences a lot of very wonderful highs from being in nature and things like that, but also periods of, quote, great anguish. Of course, it has to be very lonely and difficult to make a home for yourself in nature in this capacity. So it makes sense that all of those things might alternate or oscillate back and forth.
Right. I can imagine, like you said, the loneliness could get to you.
Yes. So he will change that shortly. In his late 30s, his friends pressure him to return to society. So on September 15th, John's birthday, mm-hmm. 1874, he goes to visit the Carrs in Oakland. And that's his chemistry professor. And while he's visiting them, he meets a woman named Louisa Strensel, who's called Louie, like Louisa May Alcott in some capacity, who is Lou. But anywho, they have an instant connection. Louie plays the piano, and whenever John and Louie's paths would cross, she would play piano for him in some capacity. John would sing along with her and the family. And then on June 1st, 1878, he remarks that they had just about made him into a member of the family, which Louis then also records in her diary. So you can see that there's a very nice connection between the two of them. Mrs. Carr, Ezra's wife, had been trying in vain to make a romantic match for the two of them. So in 1879, she really, really lays into this project, and she tries kind of separately and together to keep them in that capacity. And then eventually she is successful. They become engaged on June 17th, 1879, the day before John leaves for his first trip to Alaska. Naturally. What good timing.
Yeah, I wonder why he relented then. Wait for me, I'll be back.
Right. Well, I like the idea of her making some kind of threat, like Mrs. Carr making some kind of threat. And she was like, I'll rip up this ticket. You're not going to Alaska unless you say yes.
Yeah, I like that.
And he was like, fine. So like the day before, he decides and they wind up going. Over the course of his life, he will make four trips to Alaska alongside a group of Native American guides and a Fort Wrangell missionary. They were the first Euro-Americans to explore Glacier Bay. The Muir Glacier was later named after him. And he and the party that he is exploring with lands on the Wrangell Island on the USS Corwin, and they claim the island for the United States. And then we'll write about this experience in several different journal entries, news articles. Those later get compiled and edited down into his book, The Cruise of the Corwin. So again, you can sort of see these desires to explore and see what else is out there, but also this time kind of mingled with the problems of colonization and imperial drive that, you know, inspired so much of that early exploration in the United States. It wasn't just to see what beauty was out there, but this sort of darker ulterior motive of acquisition that we also need to acknowledge.
Which seems out of character for Muir, honestly.
Yeah, it a little like, you know, maybe he was on this trip and had to sort of reflect on those. I'd be curious to see what that book looks like. I've not read that one, but what tone he kind of takes in acknowledging that.
Right.
So eventually he gets back, and he and Louis are married on a very stormy day on April 14th, 1880, in the Strenzels' big white house decorated with astrakhan apple blossoms, which sounds, again, very poetic and lovely.
Okay. Yeah, I'm sure it smelled beautiful.
Yes. So they get settled. John takes up the family business and starts working with his father-in-law. They manage the orchards on a 2,600-acre farm in Martinez, California. So that seems a little bit, again, more like his vibe, right? Like he's working outside. He's managing this land and this farm. And they will eventually have a daughter named Wanda, who's born on March 25th, 1881, and then another daughter named Helen, who was born on January 23rd, 1886. Much like John's upbringing, his two girls would accompany him on long walks. He would teach them how to identify local flora. And then the two mountains in the area nearby, John will actually name Mount Wanda and Mount Helen, respectively, which I thought was very sweet.
Oh, yeah, what a legacy to give to your kids.
Right? So he was a very devoted father and husband. Louis would sometimes see his restlessness and shoo him back up to the mountains. He would sometimes take his daughters with him for exploring purposes. But again, I think she realized the connection that he needed to have to the environment to stay happy. But unfortunately, about 7 years into managing the fruit ranch, his health begins to suffer. So naturally, he recovers in the hills. He decides that in order to get better, he needs to climb Mount Rainier in Washington.
Yeah, that feels almost like the opposite of the maybe slightly earlier doctor saying you have to go to the coasts and the resort towns. It's like,
go to the spas of Europe, the mountain. And he's like, go climb the, what is Mount Rainier? I guess it's not like the tallest mountain in the United States, but it's a significant peak, so...
Yeah, I mean, it's at least the tallest in Washington, I think.
Well, he writes about this in his Ascent of Mount Rainier, again, another original title. But after this time, he kind of launches into his preservationism era, which I think, again, is something significant. That's what a lot of people know his work to be. He envisions the Yosemite and Sierra as pristine protected lands and specifically protected from domestic sheep. Farmers, of course, could take their sheep up to graze and shepherds could take their sheep up to graze, but that destroys a lot of the natural ecosystem of the area because, right, domestic sheep are not native to the United States. And he refers to these sheep as hoofed locusts, which I thought was very funny.
Yeah, and I think apt.
Yeah. So in June 1889, the associate editor of the Century magazine, Robert Underwood Johnson, camps out with him in this kind of wilderness area and sees firsthand the damage that domestic sheep would be doing to this grassland. And so he actually agrees to publish any article that John writes about excluding livestock from the Sierra High County. He uses this influence to introduce bills to Congress to make the Yosemite area into a national park, just like Yellowstone. And then on September 30th, 1890, Congress passes a bill that follows John's suggestions that he outlines in both of the Century articles. But unfortunately, Yosemite Valley is left under state control, which had been in existence since the 1860s.
This tension between people who own domestic livestock and conservation and preservationists goes on today.
Yes.
Especially with federal lands. Not too long ago, there was a subsection of the a community who refused to pay the grazing dues on federal land, and it ended up in a standoff between the United States federal forces and this homespun set of farmers, and I think it's hard to talk about preservation and conservation in the West without talking about this kind of real tension between the want to develop for one means or another and preserving and protecting the natural environment for many different reasons. So this is a major triumph that John is able to get some of this land protected through federal mandate.
Yeah. And again, just I think also goes to show the power of his writing. If just these articles and these experience, and I'm guessing the work that he's doing, word of mouth and that kind of thing, were enough to get these laws passed. It had to have been pretty impactful. He had to make a really strong case for this.
Right.
So in early 1892, Professor Henry Singer, who's a philologist at the University of California, Berkeley, reaches out to John with the idea of establishing a local alpine club for mountain lovers. And it seems like John is a very good person to do that with. So on May 28th, 1892, the very first meeting of the Sierra Club is held, mostly to write the articles of incorporation. So again, a good idea to get John involved with that. And 1 week later, he is elected president, and he will remain the president for the rest of his life. The Sierra Club was immediately spurred into opposing action when the Yosemite area was proposed to be reduced by half. So they immediately start getting to work to prevent that. And then at one meeting in 1895, a few years later, they discussed the idea of establishing national forest reservations, which are now known as the national forests.
Wow. It's incredible to think that that spurred out of this community meeting.
Yeah, that's what, you know, a group of really dedicated and passionate individuals can do. And we have these legacies because of them so many years later.
And it makes sense why it's called the Sierra Club, too. It's
yeah.
Tied to the mountains that's nearest to founded.
John actually hates all nature and wishes that the Sierra Club would burn down.
Yeah, absolutely. I wish for nothing more than our natural landscape to be ravaged by fire.
Great. Okay. In 1903, President Theodore Roosevelt joins John on a Yosemite trip. So you get a lot of big names in here. And while traveling to the park, he tells the president about the state mismanagement of the valley and the rampant exploitation of the resources that are available there. They had not actually even entered the park by the time he was able to convince Roosevelt that the best way to protect the land was federal management. So again, a very strong case. He does a very nice job and is very successful in that.
And if you want to see just how successful, I have a map on my wall of the national park system and forests and lands. And you want to look at the percentage of lands in the West that are federally owned. That is a sore subject or a subject of pride, depending on who you talk to. So I think it's worth a quick look up, but it's surprising on how successful this idea of federally protected lands ended up becoming.
That's very cool. So the president then asked John to show him the real Yosemite, and they set off by themselves, few, if any, presidential service are joining them, and they talk late into the night. They sleep in the brisk open air, which again feels kind of along the lines of like a Teddy Roosevelt activity. They wake up dusted by fresh snowfall. I do not know that Jackie would make it out of that endeavor. They're too cold, too much snow. And I think I would wake up again. I think this episode has just really outlined what my actual, like, self-actualized future needs to look like. It's taking classes. It's living somewhere where there's snow. That is also influenced deeply by Frog and Toad. So I'm delighted by all of this.
I look forward to visiting you in your wilderness paradise, Stephanie.
Wonderful. Everyone is welcome. And books and tea are included. So Roosevelt later tells a crowd, quote, "Lying out at night under those giant sequoias was like laying in a temple built by no hand of man, a temple grander than any human architect could by any possibility build," end quote. So you can see, again, there's this interesting tie or connection and relationship between religion and religious diction and the land, and I think human connection to nature. So it's clear that John Muir not only sees these things, but we get a lot of that in Roosevelt's reflections and people like Mary Oliver. And there's a very large tradition of writers that embrace components of religion in service of exploring nature in their literature.
Stephanie, that's well put. I think that religious language ties back into the reflection of literature I had at the start. I think it's hard to look upon nature and not immediately be drawn to speak poetically and grandly about its beauty and its power and the fact that it's ever present in our lives.
Yes, very, very true. So John becomes a naturalized American citizen in 1903. Again, remember, he's Scottish. And he again continues to write and advocate for the rest of his life for all of these natural spaces. He dies at the age of 76 on December 24th, 1914, in a California hospital of pneumonia. He is later buried at a small family cemetery in Alhambra, California. But all told, he leaves a legacy of over 300 articles, 12 different books, and of course, the Sierra Club, which today has over 2.4 million members and chapters in all 50 states. The house and ranch are actually now the John Muir National Historic Site, which you can go see today. He is often called or referred to as the patron saint of the American wilderness.
I like that moniker, Stephanie. And feels really apt. I mean, he, to use religious terms, saved a lot of land from potential other uses. And I think many of the spaces that we feel as natural pilgrimages today that are protected, either by state, federal, local edicts, I think this idea comes out of the sheer love of nature that John had.
Definitely. And I think, you know, in doing and sort of looking at a lot of these Earth Day quotes, there is something so incredibly powerful about a person who is willing to dedicate their life and kind of sacrifice all of their time and energy into saving something for future generations, right? Like, of course, John was able to enjoy all of these things while he was alive, and he spent a lot of his time doing that. But knowing that the preservation element would ensure that his daughters would be able to experience that is something that's really remarkable. And I think that is sort of where we are sort of situated, or at least a tension that I personally sort of struggle with as we're in this moment exploring climate change, is the fact that we can't seem to put aside our own needs and desires in service of a future generation. And I wish people would sort of see that it's important to take these measures now, today, to preserve all of these things for future generations to have. But we seem a little short-sighted in our recognition of what we need to do to preserve those resources and those things. So I'm hoping that this episode can inspire people to go do more research, to get connected to environmental literature, to start doing research about what they can do to reduce their impacts on the environment, and ways that you can fight and advocate for local laws that are also still in the works to help preserve these things. So just like John Muir, they'll be available for future generations to enjoy as well.
I think we ignore this advice at our peril, Stephanie, that you've just given us. And I think future generations might consider us cloven locusts if we don't change the way that on a societal level we value the natural world and its health. I think in John Muir's time, we saw an explosion of industrialization and a desire to use natural resources for economic gain in ways that may not be sustainable. And I see a lot of similarities with the time period that we have now. But maybe and hopefully it's the legacies of people like John Muir that will keep us grounded and right the ship. So I think, Stephanie, you've given us a good challenge to take up his mantle and to respect nature, not just in words, but in action.
Agreed. So no matter what way you choose to celebrate Earth Day, I hope that you take an opportunity to not only simultaneously appreciate the Earth that we have around us, but also join the fight in saving it. So appreciate the nature that is out there in the world. Go read a book of literature that makes some sort of environmental connection. There's so many lists that exist out there for you if you're looking to feel inspired. And then go get active, because that is such an important component, I think, of doing that, is that you actually do something about it. So we hope that you have all enjoyed this Earth Day episode. A delight, I think, and a treat. And next week, we are very excited to be bringing on a special guest. We'll actually be talking about a different version of environmental literature. This time, we'll be looking at the oil industry. We have Professor Jamie Jones from University of Illinois talking about her book, Rendered Obsolete. So we are very excited about that episode. Jamie, I think, is the only author that we've had that has both commented on an author in Herman Melville and also is on to talk about her own writing. So it's a wonderful conversation, and it's one that we also hope that you all enjoy. So we've had a lot of fun things on the table in the last couple of weeks and are looking for many more as we launch ourselves into our sixth season and our fifth year of doing this podcast. So thank you all for your support and encouragement along the way. It is a blast, and we appreciate it. So until we see and hear from you next time, thank you so much for your support of this podcast. And thank you, as always, for keeping it lit. There's one.